Welcome to The Patriot, 1776. Hi, this is John Mady, and I am the pastor of Victory Baptist Church in North Fort Myers, Florida. And who is the Patriot of 1776? You are, and I am, and so is everyone who loves America and wants to follow the principles of our founding fathers. The last sentence of the Declaration of Independence reads like this: "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." If it had not been for the Patriots of 1776, we would still be paying taxes to England and drinking a spot of tea at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Help us win back America now, just like the Patriots of 1776 won America in the first place. You should take notes and use your Bible. We will give you our mailing address later. Today we'll start out with a saying by a preacher, Francis Schaeffer. And Francis Schaeffer said, "Christians have largely shut up their spirituality into a small corner of life, Sunday services, church services, or their Bible studies, instead of realizing that the Lordship of Christ is to permeate the whole spectrum of life. They have coasted along complacently, often serving up such dogmas as, 'You can't mix religion and politics,' or 'You can't legislate morality,' or 'We just need to pray and witness to people,' when what they really meant was, 'We just don't want to be disturbed.' They were content in their comfort zone." End quote. Well, that's about where we are, and that's why we have this program. Because the reason we're having so much trouble in America now is simply because we have kept too quiet too long. And so we're going to continue, and in the way of a little bit of a review, we want to get these important dates. The first important date is 1215, the Magna Carta, and that's something that took place in England. The second important date is 1611, the King James Bible. That, too, took place in England. The next date is 1769, and we started last week on this particular one, and it's Blackstone's Commentaries, and this too takes place in England. And so we're going to continue on Blackstone's Commentaries, and you notice that the name of the program is The Patriot 1776. But these are things that we're talking about now. So far, all of them have taken place in England. And all these dates are dates that we need to remember, because these dates all affected America. And so we'll continue now, and we'll look at why study Blackstone's Commentaries. Commentaries on the Laws of England were published between 1765 and 1769 by Sir William Blackstone. And he lived from 1723 to 1780. But these commentaries have been abandoned in the humanistic jurisprudence, legal and constitutional philosophy. And that permeates contemporary anti-Judeo-Christian judicial decisions. Blackstone also is virtually absent from American legal education today. What, then, is the significance of Blackstonian thought to today's law? The answer is simple. The Blackstone's Commentaries are one of the most complete, consistent, humanly authored expositions of the Judeo-Christian worldwide view of law ever written. Blackstone's immeasurable influence on both English and American law was universally recognized until well into the 20th century, although the bashing of Blackstone in America began after the Civil War. Christopher Columbus Langdell, a militant evolutionist who became dean of the Harvard Law School in 1870, thought Blackstonian principles had to be ripped from American law. Not because they were wrong, but because they were a bulwark of protection against the growing humanistic movement headed by Landell and other elitists. But Blackstone's jurisprudential views were not quickly eliminated. In view of distinguished observers, the influence of Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England was phenomenal and as great in America as in England. And upon Blackstone's commentaries, United States Supreme Court Justice John Marshall and other early jurists built the American legal system. Indeed, in the most notable of Marshall's decisions, he cited Blackstone several times to advance the concept of constitutional supremacy over the power of judges. This fact is especially important today, since judicial supremacists still cite Marbury as the source of judicial power. We must forcefully and consistently insist that these judges exercise judicial review only if they understand and apply this power within the entire context of Marshall's, that is, Blackstonian philosophy. Statistics also demonstrate Blackstone's influence in America. Doctors Donald S. Lutz and Charles S. Heineman analyzed the various sources read and cited by our founding fathers. Blackstone was by far the most cited English-American scholar. The American Revolution was a revolt against the politics of English government, but not its legal foundations. The commentaries, in fact, were cited nearly 10,000 times in the reports of American courts between 1789 and 1915. In the world of humanist scholarship today, these facts are ignored because history in general is scorned as central to the process of interpreting the U.S. Constitution. But humanists, as well as the rest of us, constantly cite history. The only question is whom they cite and when that which they cite occurred. The principles of Blackstone's commentaries infuse our Constitution, and their revival deserves our most careful attention today. Who was Sir William Blackstone? Sir William Blackstone was born in 1723, several months after his father's death. His mother died when he was 12 years old. Consider a poor orphaned boy, he nevertheless received an excellent education, supported by prominent individuals, and did well in his studies. The legal profession eventually claimed him. He was entered as a student of law in the Inns of Court at the Middle Temple, and in 1746 he joined the bar. In 1750, Blackstone received the degree of Doctor of Civil Law and left the practice of law for academic life. In 1758, he was elected the first Vinerian Professor of Law at Oxford. Blackstone was highly regarded by his contemporaries who shared our Judeo-Christian worldview. Professor Frederick Maitland declared that Bracton, father of common law, was reviled by no English writer till Blackstone arose five centuries afterwards. Twice in the history of England has an Englishman had the motive, the courage, the power to write a great, readable, reasonable book about English law as a whole. But his ideas drew some criticism, particularly from Jeremy Bentham, the imperialist whose views were antithetical to Judeo-Christian worldview and significantly contributed to attacks on this worldview by later humanists. Blackstone wrote the commentaries to organize and explain English law as it had come to exist by the late 1800s. He desired to reach not only the profession of the common law, but of such others also as are desirous to be in some degree acquainted with the constitution and polity of their own country, and to render the whole of his analysis of the common law intelligible to the uninformed minds of beginners. Blackstone first presented his material as lectures, but after students sold notes purporting to be his thoughts, he published his own edition in 4 volumes. And that's the end of the introduction to Blackstone. Now, the thing to remember about all this is that Blackstone was a Christian, and that he did promote the idea of the law of mankind coming under the law of God. And if it went opposite the law of God, Blackstone said, then it's not law. But people who were godless and people who were humanists, they disagreed with this. And so they said, we need to get rid of this stuff. And so they tried even back then when he wrote his commentaries, there were still people. Of course, there have always been godless people. But here in America, this is why when we start out in 1776 and we look at 2016, we can say, what happened? And it's because we got away from the things that were godly and started doing the humanistic things. And so it was. Blackstone's commentaries were godly commentaries. I should say that the commentaries were written by a godly man. And so being written by a godly man, that's why they lasted so long in the United States. Because when we started out, we were a godly nation. And we kept following Blackstone's commentaries. They were required, if you went to college to study law, you were required to study Blackstone's commentaries. Today, it's not so. All right, well, now we're at 1769 with Blackstone's commentaries. And even though he was an English jurist, even though he was a professor of law, and even though he was followed in England and the United States, his commentaries came out in 1769. And now, the next date that we want to put on our calendar in following the United States is still about something and someone outside of the United States that affected the United States. And the date that we're going to look at now is the date 1848. 1848 is the year Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto. And so Karl Marx was born in 1818 and he died in 1883. So let's take a look, first of all, at just some information about Karl Marx. And then we'll take a look at his book. We'll see what kind of time we have left to get started in his book of the Communist Manifesto. And it's rather interesting how that book is something that's followed today. And it's amazing how the ideas that he has have already permeated the United States and our Constitution and our way of living. And most people don't even realize that how much communism is already in the United States. So we would ask the question, would you want to live under communism? Everybody would say no. But if you start naming things that are communist, they would say, no, that's not communistic. We've done that in America for a long time and not even realize that that was communism. So let's get started with this next date, 1848. And then starting with 1848, we'll read some about Karl Marx. Karl Marx was communism's most zealous intellectual advocate. His comprehensive writings on the subject laid the foundation for later political leaders, notably V.I. Lenin and Mao Zedong, to impose communism on more than 20 countries. Marx was born in Trier, Prussia, now Germany, in 1818. He studied philosophy at universities in Bonn and Berlin, earning his doctorate in Jena at the age of 23. His early radicalism, first as a member of the Young Hegelians, then as editor of a newspaper suppressed for its divisive socialism and political content, preempted any career aspirations in academia and forced him to flee to Paris in 1843. It was then that Marx cemented his lifelong friendship with Friedrich Engels. In 1849, Marx moved to London, where he continued to study and write, drawing heavily on works by David Ricardo and Adam Smith. And just to let you know, Adam Smith is one of the good guys. Marx read a lot about him and how he followed the wrong direction. Who knows? But here we go again. Let's go on. Marx died in London in 1883 in somewhat impoverished surroundings. Most of his adult life, he relied on Engels for financial support. At the request of the Communist League, Marx and Engels co-authored their most famous book, The Communist Manifesto, published in 1848, a call to arms for the proletariat, workers of the world, unite. A manifesto set down the principles on which communism was to evolve. Marx held that history was a series of class struggles between owners of capital, capitalists, and workers, the proletariat. As wealth became more concentrated in the hands of a few capitalists, he thought, the ranks of an increasingly dissatisfied proletariat would swell, leading to bloody revolution and eventually a classless society. According to Marx, capitalism contained the seeds of its own destruction. Communism was the inevitable end to the process of evolution, begun with feudalism and passing through capitalism and socialism. And so here's a good start on about Marx. And we find out that capitalism and socialism doesn't mix. And we've already studied about the Magna Carta. And it's before the Magna Carta that feudalism made its big thing. And feudalism was that the king controlled everything. And so what they wanted to do, Marx and his program, what they wanted to do was to gather all the poor people together and make everybody poor so that a few at the top could control them. And so here we go, looking at the Communist Manifesto and looking at the different things going on. I have a copy here of the Communist Manifesto. And we're going to take a look at this. And it talks about the bourgeois and the proletarians. The bourgeois are the capitalists and what they called the rich people. And the proletarians were the wage earners or the laborers, the poor people. And so what you'll find out is that they have a program put together that makes the rich go against the poor, or I should say it the other way around, makes the poor go against the rich. And so we're just going to read some of these things and give you a taste of what this is all about. And the very first thing that we're going to read, now this was written in 1848, and wouldn't you just know it today that there are the same things still going on. So we're going to start out with the history of the Communist Manifesto, and it says the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstitution of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes. In the early epics of history, we find almost everywhere a complicated arrangement of society into various orders, a manifold graduation of social rank. In ancient Rome, we have patricians, knights, plebeians, slaves. In the Middle Ages, feudal lords, vassals, guide masters, journeymen, apprentices, serfs. In almost all of these classes, again, subordinate gradations. The modern bourgeoisie society has sprouted from the ruins of feudal society and has done away with class antagonisms. But it has established new classes, new conditions of oppression, new forms of struggle in place of the old ones. Our epic, the epic of the rich, possess, however, this distinctive feature. It has simplified the class antagonisms. Society as a whole is more and more splitting up into two great hostile camps, into two great classes directly facing each other, the rich and the poor. Or another way of saying it is the capitalists and the workers. And so that's the very same thing that's going on today. That's the thing that, remember when President Obama was running for president and he was knocking on doors, and he came across a man that we know today as Jake the Plumber. And he asked Jake, "What, don't you want to, when you earn your money, don't you want to share it with some other people?" And Jake the Plumber said, "No, if I work for it, I shouldn't have to share it with other people." And he was right, because everyone ought to earn their own money. Now, when government gives out money, then we are forced to help other people. But government should never, 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 government should never help people. People should help people. And so that's where all this business comes to a terrible ending, is when you have communism, you have people that you force to help other people. And before you know it, the people that you're taking money from will eventually say, "Well, why am I working to give money to other people?" And so the idea of communism is to have the rich people to lose all their money. That's what the idea is. Listen to what the Democrats are saying today. Hillary wants to take 65% of all the, as a death tax to everyone who dies. Just take 65%. And then I've heard some other politicians say, "Oh, we need to take 100%. No one should be able to just get money from their parents or from other people and be able to go on with life. Everyone should have to earn it." But when that happens, then what happens is that people stop working. People start moving. People who have money start moving to other countries. Businesses that have money begin moving to other countries. And so we see that today. Government should never give out money. We are the most giving country in the world as far as charities are concerned. So why should we have the rich and the poor taking money from the rich and give to the poor? You'd have to ask a poor man. Did you ever get a job from a poor man? A poor man does not have a job for you. Only rich people have jobs for you. And in our country, in a lot of cases, we can go down to small business, and the whole idea of hiring someone is to expand your business, so that someone that you hire should be able to increase your business to the point where not only does he increase the business and make some money for himself, but he also increases the business to help the owner of that small business to go on. And it's the same with large businesses too. If you can't contribute to the business to help it to grow besides giving you your own pay, then why would a company hire you? And so we have all these things going on. It's very easy to see. I had the privilege of going down and protesting against the protesters that were camped out at one of the parks in Fort Myers. And they had signs all over one of their walls, and there was one sign that said, "Workers of the World Unite." And I asked the leader, I said, "Why do you have that communist sign up there?" And he said, "We don't have any communist sign up there." And I said, "You don't understand that you have a communist sign up there?" And he said, "No, we don't have a communist sign up there." And I said, "Well, why do you have that sign that says, 'Workers of the World Unite'?" I said, "Don't you understand that that is one of the last sentences in the Communist Manifesto, and you're promoting it?" And so he was very surprised. He didn't understand it, and he invited me to come and teach them classes on it. I refused to do it at that time, but that was, they have no understanding of what communism is. All right. So comes the end of today's message. We appreciate so much that you spent time to be with us. If you enjoy our program, would you please take time to send us any questions you might have, along with a love offering of any amount? And if you send at least $25, we will send you a 92-page book, When Good Men Do Nothing, Who Will Speak? Our address is The Patriot, 1776, at 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Again, The Patriot, 1776. The address is 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Talk to you again next time. Goodbye now.